Welcome to the Serious TV Drama Podcast with Scott and Dan. I'm Scott, and with me as always, the pig's tails to my Peking duck, it's Dan. How are you doing this fine evening, Daniel?
Well, it feels like we haven't talked for, like, ever, so I guess I'm probably doing good. How are you doing?
The longer we don't speak, the better you're doing. I like the correlation there. I'm doing fine. I'm glad we're sitting down to get our latest Hannibal podcast out there. I know we've delayed it by a few days, but it figures whenever we actually delay these things, that's when you start seeing little messages on Facebook like, when's your next top Hannibal? And it's like, oh god. But we're here to talk about the latest Hannibal, but there was also a little bit of news Hannibal wise over the last week, so I thought I should fill everybody in on that first. Although I bet everyone knows it by the time they listen to this podcast, but I don't care. Earlier this week, we had a few more bleak tidings for the hashtag Save Hannibal campaign because both Netflix and Amazon apparently passed on picking up season 4 of Hannibal. The rumor seems to be that Amazon was actually concerned about how long they'd have to wait for there to be new episodes, and that's due to Brian Fuller's commitment to doing the first season of American Gods before he can get to any Hannibal episodes. So it's almost like a catch-22 for Brian Fuller by his own success, so to speak.
Yeah.
So, you know, now why Netflix passed on it as well, possibly the same reason or more so, don't know. At that point, he still believed that there would be a chance for the show, but, you know, I even have to confess it's not looking quite as good as it did a few weeks ago. There was also a panel for Hannibal at the San Diego Comic-Con, which was referred to, God help me, as Pannibal, hashtag Pannibal on Twitter, of course. So everyone was there, all the major actors, including some that we haven't seen yet because we haven't gotten to those episodes, so I won't even spoil anything about that. The one little piece of, I don't even know if it's news or just a possibility that Brian Fuller dropped there was while he's still in discussions and hoping to land the show with another network or a cable provider or internet service, there's still a possibility he may choose to go the feature film route. I gotta say, as much as I want there to be more Hannibal, I'm not really keen on the idea of going the feature film route. I don't see the point of that.
Well, yeah, there's already five films, so I don't know if we really need any more of that.
Plus,
you know, if it was good, it'd be okay. But I mean, which it probably would be good. But it's just like, you know, I kind of like keeping it separate in my mind. So like, yep, the TV Hannibal, I like it better than all the film stuff for the most part.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would go that far with most of the films. I couldn't say that about Silence of the Lambs. It's just too much of a classic for me. But if this show is struggling to get a million people to watch it, how does that make sense financially to make a feature film? is my concern. If people aren't bothering to watch it when it's there for free, why would you expect there to be more people who will spend 10, 12, 15, whatever, depending where you live, dollars per ticket to see it? I don't know. Plus, one of the things I've enjoyed about the series up to a point is that they can take their time, and I put a big asterisk next to that comment right now, with the storytelling. Although this season especially, maybe I'm starting to realize maybe they should have even shorter seasons than they have already. I don't know. But to compress it, go back to the idea of compressing it all into a two-hour movie, presumably two-hour movie, I think loses something. I don't know. Anyway, in any case, I'm sort of opposed to it, but if that's what happens as opposed to not getting anything at all, maybe I'll be okay with it. I don't know what story they would use for the feature film, but I guess we don't really know how the season's quite going to end yet, so there's no way to really know where they would be going with a film, you know?
Huh. Maybe they could do like a 90-minute where they're like investigating some serial killer that just like tries to turn people into snails or something. That'd be kind of cool.
Okay, so that's a good cue to get to the latest. So, goddamn snails. Although I did send out a bunch of my lamest tweets ever the other day, where I was telling really bad Hannibal jokes. So one tweet was, what's Hannibal's favorite form of communication? Why, snail mail, of course. All right, so let's get to the latest episode of Hannibal before we lose every single listener possible. The latest episode was called Dolce. Hey, you know what? I actually forgot to look up what Dolce technically means, although I kind of know what it means. Probably everyone else knows what it means, so maybe I don't need to give a definition of it. You know what it means, right?
No, I can't remember right now. I mean, I know, but it's just blanking, so.
Well, I think when you think of Dolce as an adjective, it usually means sweet. So my guess, since this has been an Italian meal, perhaps it's referring to the dessert, I would guess. That would make sense considering everything else that's been served so far. So, yeah. So therefore, this episode, they are considering the dessert of the season so far.
Huh. Well,
not sure how I feel about that. Because I'll say right up front before we get to the recap, I had some problems with this episode. And I don't actually know. Maybe by the time we finish talking about it, I'll know if they were outweighed by the things I enjoyed. I don't know. I was more on the fence with this episode than almost any other this season, I think.
Yeah, I'm in the same boat there, where it was just, you know, I mean, I guess I was into it while I was watching it, but I'm sure I had a really weird look on my face most of the time.
Yes, I think there are a couple key moments which I would imagine, I can imagine your face watching with a, what the, whatever kind of thing. So let's get to the episode. So we open with this little blip, blop, bloop, figurative bloodbath for Lecter, which is not the one that we usually refer to back at his house in season two. It's him being bathed of the blood that was all over him. This is being cross-cut with him staggering through what apparently is the empty city of Florence. I kept thinking, wait, there's no one anywhere on the streets of this city while this guy who's soaked in blood is walking around? Okay, sure. I'll go along with it. As for that bath, instead of being the person in the tub, this time Bedelia is doing the cleaning or cleansing, and she's even stitching him up, quite frankly. Meanwhile, we see that the body of Inspector Pazzi is cut down under Jack Crawford's supervision, and at that exact moment, Will appears, you know, like magic. So they're discussing Hannibal here, and Jack notes that he's wounded and he's worried, but Will doesn't think Hannibal ever worries, which I guess makes sense because, well, I would say Lecter's pretty much a sociopath. You know, it's, regardless of any comments he seems to make regarding emotions or feelings, he kind of makes Mr. Spock look like Richard Simmons a little bit sometimes. Now, this is like the first red flag in the episode for me, and this, I'm willing to let it go because it's not worth dwelling on, I guess, because I've noticed more so this season than the first two, that matters of reason and logic don't really apply to this show right now. But, okay, how does Jack and Will automatically determine that Bazzi was going to sell Lecter? I mean, just because he didn't involve the police and went on his own, that's the conclusion they reach? Which was the same thing that Hannibal did as well? I don't know. I just felt like this was kind of a big leap for everyone, a conclusion that for everyone to come to. I mean, because I was sitting there, I was thinking about it. Like, couldn't they just have easily assumed that it was his own obsession that led him to make such a blunder? You know, it just seems weird because both Will and Jack's encounters with Pazzi they would see him as a guy who was consumed at restoring his reputation, or at least seeking justice for those victims from 20 years ago. So why they suddenly would think he's become a bounty hunter? I mean, they're right, of course, but I think it was more of a writer's convenience. I was having a hard time believing they would just come to that conclusion that easily, if that makes any sense.
Yeah, I don't know. I didn't pay close attention to it. You know, maybe Jack got some kind of read on him when they were talking in the last episode and knows what's going on. Knows it's the bounty, I suppose, but I don't know.
That's possible. I just thought it was funny that there's a certain amount of hypocrisy with their conclusion, because they're basing it on the fact the guy is operating outside of the law and not telling the local police what they're up to or about Lecter, and that's what they're doing. That's exactly what they're doing. And they're not even officers of the law in that country. So it's even more likely that they would be quote-unquote bounty hunters, and we know that they're not. So I don't know if that's just an indication that people like Jack and Will are kind of flawed, or they're just not very self-aware. But although most of the season seems like Will trying to discover his own awareness about himself, I don't know. All right, so I digress. I'll get back to the episode. I guess Jack is wondering if Lecter manages to slip away, is Will going to join him? You know, referring to what he said earlier in the season about how he wanted to run away with Lecter. Will here, he admits that parts of him will always want to. So basically they have Will Graham continuing to sound like someone who's never quite gotten over a crush or a lost love or something like that. But what I liked here was what Jack says to him. He tells him that you need to cut that part out. And I like that because he's kind of using his now dead wife's words, because that was how she referred to what he needed to do, but cutting a part out that was keeping him from moving on. And finally, we get the comment that I think many people were thinking. You know, Will says to him, why didn't you kill him? And Jack's response is, maybe I need you to. And I mean, we talked about this last week, I said, well, obviously they have to have Will be the one to catch Hannibal, not Jack, although it didn't seem to work out that way. But in that scene, on one hand, I liked the exchange, but it really felt like it was more of a conceit of the story than really being plausible, because I don't think Jack would have willingly let Hannibal go just because he felt Will should be the one to do the honors. But I was like, okay, I'm fine with it. I get what he's saying. I don't think he's quite being literal when he says that.
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm sure he feels kind of responsible for the way Will's kind of like, sank into the darkness, because he just, kept pushing him and wouldn't let him go and stuff. So maybe he's just trying to use this to bring him back a little bit because he feels guilty.
Yeah, I could see that. He's using it as a means of not encouraging, but sort of supporting him. I don't know. But, obviously he would not have let Hannibal go because of that, he just did the dumb move of punching him out the window instead of, shooting him. Although he probably didn't have a firearm on him, because he probably couldn't have gotten it through customs. Anyway, back to the story. We're with Hannibal and Bedelia now. Oh, I like this. He's talking about how he'd like to be able to sketch all Florence and the Duomo from memory, because, memories will soon be all he's going to have of Florence. I like that, because if memory serves me correctly, that's one of the things we see Hannibal Lecter doing in the movie Silence of the Lambs, when he's been imprisoned there. I believe that Clarice even comments on it. We see sketches of the Duomo and other things that he remembered from Florence. So I like the little tie-in there. But Dilly at one point does finally say to him, this is where I leave you, or more accurately, you leave me. And that clearly is not how Hannibal anticipated they were going to part. So then they have this little back and forth about she knows he planned to eventually eat her, but, had no intention of eating her hastily, but he seems to agree he wanted to savor her. It goes on and on for a few lines, and I'm staring at the screen. I'm enjoying it, because I do enjoy I guess it's banter between the two of them. It's hard to describe. But I was like, okay, we get it. You're not really talking about cannibalism here. All right, fine. And then I think the scene ends with, you may make a meal of me yet, Hannibal, but not today. Which I like because it's a great line with just a little bit of a kinky flavoring to it. So when we come to the next act, we see piggies and we see Pigtails and Cordell, who is Mason Berger's, I guess his man Friday, is preparing foods that I guess are meant to replicate the experience of eating a human being. Because apparently, like, the pigtail chunks, he says that they would taste something like fingers, and then he actually is serving him marrow and other things. I'm not sure how Cordell would know that, but, you know, perhaps he Googled it. Cannibal.com or something, I don't know. But I thought it was interesting that Mason clearly doesn't have the same sort of palate for things the way Hannibal does. But then I was thinking, does Mason even have a palate anymore? You know, in the literal sense? Or maybe Cordell just isn't as good a cook as Hannibal? I don't know. But then the scene gets really, I guess I would say beautifully bizarre, when Cordell suggests that he prepare Lecter like Peking duck. According to Cordell, when you make Peking duck, and I've never heard this before, but it could be true. I haven't read the same cookbooks that Cordell has. The bird is tortured before being cooked. And it's pumped full of air and hung till it's dead. Then it's glazed with honey and roasted. I was thinking, that description alone probably just made a few thousand more people vegetarians. Although I don't think the show really does a lot for the meat-eating industry anyway. But, and then we get the weirdness of Verger either imagining or dreaming that Lecter has been laid across a long table and been cooked as though he's Peking duck. I also thought it was kind of interesting to note that in his, I guess we'll call it his dream, Verger imagines himself to be walking normally, but he still remains horribly disfigured in his dream. So I was thinking, wait, so he's got who knows how many flaws, as we've seen both last season and this season, but being vain apparently is not one of them. Or maybe in some weird way he's actually become proud of the scars of his face. I don't know. It's very strange. Later, we see the two Vergers, brother and sister, Cordell and Alana Bloom. They're all together, and they're watching an Italian news report about Inspector Bazzi's murder. In which we get this line, I feel like I just paid a lot of money for a dead Dago. I love the occasional little bits of prejudice and racism that show up here and there with Mason. But Alana, she seems to be concerned that this is all going to get traced back to Mason Verger, and maybe even more importantly, that Lecter might get away as a result of all this.
Did you notice her pronounce his name as Patsy, too?
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Yeah. I'm not sure if they did that on purpose or if she just, like, you know, read the line weird, but either way, it was kind of, you know, it works.
Cool. One idea that they do mention here, which I will say I initially thought was a joke and then turned out to be true, was that Verger should essentially buy or bribe the entire Florence Questura, which is their police force, to prevent any connection to the murder. And maybe, I guess, get some assistance with those other Lecter-related issues. Okay, I know this was shown to be true. That's what ends up happening. But I was like going, wait. Really? Really? The entire force is going to be on the take? Is that precinct like the Italian version of Gotham or something? Every cop is easily bought and corrupt there? I don't know. Go get you some more Parmesan. Anyway, so next we see something which I got confused initially because we see Bedelia's about to shoot up. You know, she's got the thing wrapped around her arm. And I was wondering, wait, have we seen her use drugs before? I don't remember that.
I don't think so.
And then I initially assumed, oh, maybe this is how she's been dealing with hanging out with Hannibal all this time. So what I'm basically saying is that it didn't occur to me at this point that this was Bedelia beginning what I guess is the construction of her alibi. And I didn't get to think about it too much longer because that's when Chio shows up. All right. And I was already kind of longing for snails at that point. So can we both give some major props right now to Miss Gillian Anderson? Because the fact is that she can still be as fun and interesting and compelling as she was in this scene while sharing the screen with who I think has been little more than a stick of wood. Is, I think, a huge credit to her own craft. I also want to mention, she looks... I've always liked Gillian Anderson, and, you know, she's attractive, you know. But, whoa, she's, like, truly smoking hot in this episode.
You and me, you know, we watch TV for different reasons, but even I noticed it, so... I'm just like, holy shit, you know. I mean, what was X-Files, like, 30 years ago? I mean, like, what the hell? I mean, damn...
Well, I was just thinking, like, in that moment, like, just in the last 5 minutes of that scene, she looked better than she did in the entire series The Fall that I watched. Oh, by the way, in case anyone makes a joke about this later online, this has nothing to do with the fact that she's in a somewhat drugged state. I'm not Bill Cosby here. Anyway, back to Chio. Yeah, I guess it looks like she's been walking around Florence, toting like this big gun, hoping to help Cage Lecter or something. And, you know, yes, I know later we see that she's using a case, but although I think it would take a little bit of time to unpack that rifle to have it to be ready to fire. But I just like that when you first see it with the big gun, I keep thinking, wow, Italy's like the old West or something. Like it's like a Sergio Leone movie. She can just walk around with a big gun. But, you know, back to the scene, she's exchanging some words with Bedelia, but I'll be honest, I kind of started to tune out anything that was coming out of her mouth. I was like, blah, blah, blah. It's like a teacher on the Peanuts cartoon or something. But I did pay attention when Bedelia wondered if maybe Will Graham wasn't Lecter's biggest mistake, but this woman was. Because I wrote a note, yeah, I think it's more Brian Fuller's mistake. Yeah, no offense in case Mr. Brian Fuller should ever listen to our podcast in some bizarro alternate reality world where there's no other podcasts in the universe. But, you know, anyway, I think like most viewers, Bedelia can't be bothered with Chio anymore because, you know, she needs to take her medicine. So Chio leaves and then Bedelia injects herself with, I don't know, whatever happy fun juice is in that syringe. And then I think, oh my gosh, are we going to get like a truly trippy, like a Vertigo-like sequence here? And then all of a sudden there's like a knock at the door. It's like, damn it. You know, the Killjoy twins show up. It's like Will and Jack are on our doorstep. So when we come back, we see that Bedelia is being questioned by Will and Jack. And I remember thinking, wow, Bedelia is incredibly witty and even perceptive for someone who's also clearly high on some elaborate cocktail of drugs. And I can't remember. I think it's Will who makes the connection that it's probably the same combination of drugs that Lecter gave Miriam Lass. That was the character that was played by Anna Chlumsky, you know, otherwise known as the fake Clarice Starling from the last two seasons. Anyway, they're clearly not buying Bedelia's story here, that she's, you know, quote, under some sort of delusion, thinking that she actually is Lydia Fell.
Yeah, the fact that there's a ton of great acting here, you know, between, you know, her being all drugged out and the two of them just, like, having just no patience for it at all, just barely tolerating it.
Yes, it's, and I kept thinking, I bet if there are that many scenes on the show that have bloopers, I'm betting this scene has a few because I can imagine one of them starting to crack up, especially after the way she delivers some of her lines here.
Yeah, if it wasn't for this scene, this episode would be, you know, I don't know if it'd be irredeemable, but it certainly wouldn't be on the, you know, it would be a early contender for like worst episode, I'd have to say, but this definitely helped it at least a little bit.
Yeah, I'm not sure I would disagree with you, quite frankly. but because this scene probably was one of the, if not the highlight of the episode. And back to her performance. I love the fact that I don't even think she's really trying to sell her alibi here, because she is truly letting some choice little bits of snarky commentary slip in. So she does not sound like any sort of innocent woman. You know, I love the phrase that they use, that she's freebasing her alibi. But she's kind of being a smartass, because she wonders, you know, why the polizia have not arrived to question her themselves. You know, I wish she kept saying that. Like, where's the polizia? I don't see no polizia. You see the police? I don't see no police. But speaking of people we haven't seen. Will disappears. Oh, by the way, there's a comment made here that I guess she makes as well, that also imply that the police have been bought by somebody. So, you know, even like, you know, Little Miss Acid Queen has enough mental clarity to come up with that. I don't know. I kept thinking, you know, if I took that liberty to have characters just jump to conclusions in anything I wrote, you know, I'd end up being ripped apart like a sack of newborns being fed to Mason's pigs or something. I don't know. But whatever. I'll go along with it, because if that was the biggest problem I had with the episode, then this would be a great episode. And that was by far not the problem. So we go back to, I guess, Vergerville. And then we kind of get what might be one of the creepiest scenes that does not involve any kind of gore or violence. It's, you know, it's another scene between Margot and Mason. We learn that Margot is apparently the one who's making sure that the police in Florence have all been well paid off. And by recognizing all the help that she has given him, you know, Mason is summoning her to his bedside. And when he says, come on and sit on Santa's lap. It's like, oh my God. He wants to make her wishes come true, but of course he pretty much made that impossible when he had her uterus removed. You know, which is pretty much an unspeakable act that somehow they spin it to be her fault. You know, because, you know, Mason, he didn't want to have an heir getting underfoot, and nor I don't think he ever wanted to stop being the center of his sister's universe either. I gotta make this comment now, and this is a positive one for the episode or the show in general. I've seen several really bizarre brother and sister combos on TV over the years. You know, and I don't mean like Wednesday and Pugsley from the Addams Family or Ross and Monica from Friends or something like that. The one that actually came to mind was from a TV series from over 25 years ago. It was a rather wildly inappropriate and bizarre brother and sister combo. That was their names were Mel and Susan Prophet. They were played by Kevin Spacey in probably his major dramatic debut on television, and Joan Severance. We're going to talk about that series on a future podcast at some point, I think. But they were like this really bizarre, creepy brother-sister who there's always this sort of implication of there may be something more or just want something more, but they never quite is. As opposed to like Cersei and Jaime on Game of Thrones, who because they're just out and out incestuous, it becomes less creepy as a result, I think. But anyway, back to this creepiness. We get Mason offering to palm off some of his presumably still viable sperm if Margot herself can find an appropriately available uterus. I kid you not. I was saying out loud, please don't be Alana. Please don't be Alana. Please don't be Alana. And, well, we'll get to that shortly. Oh, by the way, I thought that the idea of Mason Verger taking parenting classes is probably as ridiculous or insane as imagining, like, Hannibal Lecter eating at a White Castle or something. So, speaking of Lecter, Will finds him at that gallery, where he's again sketching that Botticelli painting. You're just the way the now dead inspector used to always see him 20 years earlier. Oh boy. And then they engage in their, I guess we could call it lovingly crafted riddle speak, although it does test my patience occasionally. So boiling it down to its essence, the point was, you know, Will left on his trip to Lithuania to gain a greater understanding of Lecter and maybe himself at the same time. But now he's saying, like, the differences between himself and Hannibal have become more of a blur. And I guess that's kind of fitting in this moment, because they're both sitting next to each other and they're pretty much equally bloodied, cut and bruised. They almost are as if they're mirror images of each other. So, and clearly that's what they're going for here. There was a moment that made me laugh, because it was just bizarre, when Will tells Hannibal about Chio threw him off the train, and Hannibal's response is, "Atta girl?" Which is really a phrase I don't really think being in Hannibal Lecter's lexicon, which probably made it that much more amusing, I guess. But at the same time, I kept thinking, the fact that these two feel like they're almost twins right now, I was wondering, what would Chio say? And then I immediately thought, wait, I wouldn't want to know what Chio would say. Let's get back to this. Now, at this point, it seems to me like Lecter was resigned to his fate, and that he was leaving with Will. The implication is that to turn himself in. That's kind of the way I saw it. Did you see it that way, or am I just totally misunderstanding this?
Yeah, I saw it completely differently. Like, Hannibal, like, in complete control of the situation, like, knowing what was going to happen, had it all set up just to fuck with him even more.
Okay, I think that's the accurate way to look at it, so points to you, and no points for me. Because once they're outside, the only thing worse then maybe it's starting to rain snails is the fact that, you know, we see that Chio is like peering at them through the sights of her like stupid big ass rifle that she got, but now there's like a little suppressor on it and stuff, a silencer for those people who don't know what a suppressor is. And I guess the moment she sees that there's a switchblade in Will's hand, poof, you know, she shoots him. I guess in like the clavicle area or something. So it gave me yet another reason not to like her, quite frankly. You know, Chion. Anyway.
Why exactly Will like was pulling a knife in the first place, in like the middle of like the freaking courtyard or wherever the hell they were?
I'll tell you why. And I'm totally seat of my pants coming up with this right now, and I'm basing it off what you just said. Because if Will is aware that Lecter is screwing with him and thinks that he's in control and leading him on, that would be Will's chance to turn the tables on him. To do something in a place and time that Lecter wouldn't expect it, outside in public, might be the one chance he would have to pull that off, as opposed to in his home or something like that. That's my guess. I can't think of any other reason to do that. I mean, it obviously didn't work. But back to the... Oh, God, here we go. So we go from a scene that had a character who means little or nothing to me to a scene that means even less to me. I don't even think if I was 14, I would have cared about this scene, even though, you know, we get some, you know, lesbianic love going on here. It's, you know, Alana and Margot are engaged in, you know, sex, whatever, but it's done in this whole weird kaleidoscope fashion. I mean, yes, I get the artsiness of it, but putting that aside, I got really annoyed with this moment. I was like, why am I being subjected to this? Why is she suddenly with Alana? Why would Alana be into this at all? Has there been a hinting of this that I didn't... I mean, I know they had a scene together. I don't really remember it really that coming off from that scene. Isn't this really the wrong, and let's really be honest, isn't this really the wrong gay coupling for this series, because it's really the Will and Hannibal series, not these two? I mean, yes, it was pretty to look at, but it made me so annoyed. I didn't get it. The blurring was supposed to be about Will and Hannibal, yet they do it with these two. And I get maybe they're trying to set up there being a kind of a parallel, but that's kind of bullshit. Look, Margot Verger I know is a lesbian in the books. No problem with that. In fact, if memory serves in the books, she's kind of somewhat of a manly butch lesbian, quite frankly. You know, she's certainly not a lipstick lesbian. But this kind of pissed me off because unless this becomes intrinsically necessary to the story of the next couple episodes, then I don't believe it. I don't think the fact that, you know, I don't think the defenestration, I get to use the word, yay, of Alana would suddenly lead her to becoming like a sorority girl experimenting in college or something. I mean, I can't believe I'm knocking an episode for a lesbian scene because you'd figure, oh, yay. But no. It annoyed me. Honestly, this scene alone knocked down the episode a grade for me because I just got that annoyed with it.
Yeah, and it was just dumb.
And even after they're finished, you know, I did like what Margo was wearing as she was getting dressed. That I liked. I liked that more than the scene. But
I hate her hair, though.
Ugh. I wasn't looking at her hair, but I'll take your word for it. That's when Margo brings up the idea of harvesting sperm before Mason would end up going to prison. And I remember going, wait, is that why we just had this stupid scene? However, the saving grace, well, okay, it's not really a saving grace, but the one interesting bit of information other than that is realizing at this point that Alana still has a bit even more of a moral compass than I might have thought, because she seems to believe that Mason will and probably should go to prison, but after Hannibal is dealt with. Yeah. Then we switch to this scene. Oh, gosh. Yeah, a douche from the Questura is questioning Jack and Bedelia about her husband. I don't know if we give this guy a name, so I just refer to him as a douche in all my notes. El douche. Jack actually suggests that he just goes online and, you know, access VICAP, and he'll see that the Dr. Phil that they're pursuing is actually Hannibal Lecter. But the Italian douche doesn't really seem surprised, makes it clear he has no need to talk to Jack, you know, waves him off. He says he can leave, but he still wants more information from Bedelia. That's, yeah, we can just skip from that on, I guess. To Hannibal, he's kind of trying to carve that bullet out of Will. He seemed to know that Chio was protecting him, you know, even as he shows Will his own switchblade, which certainly gives more credence to what you said earlier, makes it, you know, that much more obvious now that I think about it. Then he injects, and I was assuming, oh, what, another one of those little infamous drug concoctions? He injects into Will's armpit. I don't know why his armpit. And I was like, oh no, because we haven't had enough out of focus, echo laden scenes in this episode already. But they give us a break. They let us go to commercial for a few minutes before we get the latest mind bending visuals, which, look, all I could say was like, wait, is this the opening credits for the next season of True Detective? It really looked like that. It just, you know, just needed a better song. I am not going to waste our time trying to describe this hallucination because it's as purely visual as it gets. It's, why bother? I'm assuming if you're listening to this podcast, you saw it, so you don't need me to describe. I don't know what words I would use to describe it. You know, poofs and puffs and I don't know. But I guess we were seeing and experiencing something within Will's own, I guess, his own mind's eye. Not to be confused with what he said earlier about being plunged into what he called the hot darkness of Lecter's mind, which I kind of skipped it earlier, but that's quite the sexual innuendo-laden phrase, the hot darkness alone, jeez. Anyway, but when Will comes to, you know, then we see Matthew McConaughey. No, I'm just kidding. When Will comes to, we realize, oh, he's going to be another unwilling guest to one of Lecter's dinners. But here, the only food on the table is a bowl of some rather mysterious soup. My first thought, even though that means he would have kept it in the freezer for many, many years now, is did he keep some of his you know, his special Sister Misha broth on him? He's sharing his sister with Will. But although Lecter is getting ready to leave Florence at this point, apparently he did take the time to set the place for one more guest. Now, it's obviously the implication is Jack Crawford. And then for a second, I was like, wait, is it Chio? Because they both get on the elevator together to go up to the apartment. Go ahead.
I was just like, Chio, like, what the fuck is Chio doing? I mean,
I have no idea.
It's a dumb character, but like the motivations are just like completely just like, okay, what?
Okay, I'm going to take 15 seconds to say right now. I want to make it clear right now, something occurred to me the other day, yesterday. I'm knocking the character, not the actress. I don't know if the actress is necessarily all that bad. I think it's just the way this character is, and the character is written to be kind of annoying. This has nothing to do with the fact that I know now that this actress will be in Batman v Superman Dawn of Justice next year, but yeah, it does. I get the impression she's working for Lex Luthor. Anyway, back to Hannibal. So they're on the elevator, and it's kind of all right. She's kind of noticing Jack's gun, and I guess Jack sort of seems like he might be suspicious of her and that long case that she's carrying, but clearly not enough to do anything about it. So because he's kind of in pursuit of Lecter mode here, and you know, he has his gun drawn when he enters that apartment. And he finds Will, you know, still bound to the chair. And this one I saw coming. I don't know if you, I bet you did too, because I was yelling at the screen. I was like, he's under the table. He's under the table. He's under the table. Don't walk near the table. And then Will kind of says it. But next thing you know, Hannibal kind of slices him. And I guessed he was probably slicing his Achilles tendon, which, if that's true, Jack's going to be limping for the rest of his life now. Because clearly everyone on this show needs to have a problem walking. You know, Hannibal's limping around, Will's limping around, Alana's limping around, Morgan's got his walking issues, and now Jack will too. So they cut to commercial again, but when we come back, God forbid we get back to the scene that we're actually freaking out about, but instead we're back to the douche and Bedelia scene. And then, you know, obviously he's there to collect that bounty, which we all know. So in her days, she says something along the lines that her husband will be found in the one place that he shouldn't be, which I guess turns out to be the residence of the different professors at the Palazzo. I guess that's what that place is supposed to be. We get back to the scene that we want to see what's going on. Okay, you finish moving around there. Now Jack is at the other end of the table. I noticed that by Jack there were some IV bags that were set up, and which was strange. And I guess Hannibal says something which pretty much implies that Jack is pretty much paralyzed from the neck down. So that's gotta suck. And he says something that, as he's getting ready with the what turns out to be a little hand buzzsaw kind of a thing, that Jack was the first to suggest getting inside your head. But now we both have the opportunity to chew quite literally what we've only chewed figuratively. By the way, I feel no guilt or shame about any of the food or eating puns I've done in any of our podcast descriptions, since Hannibal seems to do it himself all the time. And then, Jesus Christ, he starts sawing through Will's head. It's like, oh my God, because blood is like spattering everywhere and Will's actually vibrating from the power of the saw. And I was like, what are they doing? Were they watching Game of Thrones? Like, are they going in a direction I really didn't expect them to go here?
Did you notice the blood was all like flowing upwards like it was for Jack when he was locked in Hannibal's pantry or whatever?
It didn't occur to me until you said that. So,
yeah. So I suppose it's just a Jack thing, but don't know what it means. But sure there's some kind of meaning to it.
Probably some sort of God thing or something. But good catch. See, even if you don't say much, you catch things like that, which I miss, so that's cool. Well, then we see, I love this, we see what the improbable reflection, the reflection of what's going on in a drop of blood that's floating in the air. By the way, I don't think blood can actually reflect things and you can see, but anyway. But then suddenly the backdrop of the blood in the air, it's the sun breaking through the clouds. And all of a sudden we're on like a snowy road that's lined with trees. And then we're inside what I guess appears to be like a slaughterhouse or I guess the correct word might be an abattoir. And we see pigs hanging. And so are Hannibal and Will. And then, like many things in this episode, we see something which is kind of blurry. And then it wheels forward and the focus sharpens and we see that it's Mason Verger. And we end the episode with him saying, "Gentlemen, welcome to Muskrat Farm." And thus endeth Dolce. You know, I enjoyed talking about the episode more or describing it more than I think I did
watching. Yeah.
Well, okay. Let's break this down briefly. I liked all the Bedelia on drug scenes, even the one with the douchey and cop from Millie, because she kind of made the scenes come alive. So I liked that part. I liked the end scene with them at the table because I didn't know where they were going with this, and I liked the tension of it, I guess. So I don't have a problem with that. And I always enjoy any. I've decided I enjoy every scene that has Mason Verger in it. I think he's pretty much the comic relief on this show. He's like the evil Saul Goodman or something. I don't know. He makes me laugh every scene. But oh God, I mean some of the other stuff. Huh. I know people have said this, and I'm gonna get on the train to a certain extent, although I might get pushed off like Will did. This half of the season does feel like they kind of dragged it out a bit. And it's very beautiful to look at, and it's artsy, and there's very... the dialogue can veer between borderline pretentious to really cool, whatever. But I feel like I'd be a hypocrite if when we talk about a show like... And God forgive me. When we talk about The Walking Dead and how I talk about, but there's so many episodes that are kind of filler and they drag out a storyline which could have been done in just a few episodes. I'm sort of kind of feeling that way about what's going on in Italy here. You know?
Yeah, yeah.
I just wish it had been compressed a bit more. And like I think I said in the previous podcast, it's not a coincidence that I'm not a big fan of the original stories that are inspiring a lot of this. That's not helping matters. I mean, the performers are all doing their Chio aside, the actors are all doing a great job, and there's great moments and scenes, and there's certain. And I did enjoy the episodes up to a point, but this one, I think for whatever reason, it kind of like annoyed me more than it should have. And maybe I went to this episode expecting it to be. I thought this was going to be like a great episode. Maybe I let the ads mislead me. I guess. That's my bad, obviously. I should really know better.
But yeah, I don't know. This is the first season that I've watched it week by week, you know, so I'm used to being able to just, you know, plow through a whole season at a time. And, you know, this episode probably would have, I mean, I never was going to be great in the first place, but if I didn't have time to think about it after the fact and just got right into just like, you know, see what the hell's going on with Will's fucking skull getting cut open. You know, that maybe it'd be a little bit less
obviously it's a, you know, part I'll throw in the curse word change. Yeah, it's a total what the fuck moment, but it didn't make me angry. I was like, I liked the fact it was ballsy. And the fact that Will's kind of got like a bizarre almost smile on his face when he's hanging upside down because, you know, well, he's... You know, he's probably never been so happy to see Mason Verger before. But it's just, it's got there, when you add up all these episodes, there does tend to be a bit more of a ponderousness to it that I wish wasn't there. I don't mind the artsiness at times. Obviously, some of it I think is beautiful to look at, or I get the deeper metaphor. But this episode just made me go, oh, okay, you know what you guys are doing right now? You're dragging this out, and you know what? I know that Red Dragon is on the horizon.
Yeah,
that's like my favorite. As I said in the very first Hannibal podcast, you know, only my favorite book of all time, just about, and so therefore one of my favorite stories of all time. And all you're doing is dragging this out, not getting to it. You know, I don't even care that I heard that an actress that I hated on True Blood is going to be in the second half of the season. I was like, you know what? I bet I'll love her on this because it's Red Dragon. You know, but Jesus Christ, get to it already. You know, you keep doing crap like this, you're going to get canceled. Oh, wait a minute.
For me, this episode was kind of like, I mean, you know, even the issues we had with Game of Thrones this season were just like, you know, it's still doing like the Hannibal thing. But it's just like so like over like they just this episode was just too much. I mean, just too gratuitous, and they just did like all their thing. But it was just like way, way, way over the top, and the story itself really wasn't, I mean, you know, anything great this week. So
yeah, stuff happened, but not enough happened. You know, it just okay. You know what? I like the fact that, you know, Hannibal became like your favorite current show on TV, right? And it's one of my favorites as well. So I'm kind of proud of the fact that we can still be negative about it if we want to be. So,
yeah.
Hopefully next week we'll be a bit more positive. I mean, obviously, it's, you know what? Next week's certainly going to be a lot more Mason Verger, so that alone is making me look forward to it. I'm thinking maybe now that we're out of Italy, still a country which is number one on my list of places I want to visit overseas, but I'm kind of happy we're not in Italy anymore, because maybe next week it'll be fun with Mason Verger. And, you know, not much of a spoiler alert, the episode after that is the beginning of the Red Dragon storyline, so pretty sure everything kind of gets wrapped up. So
yeah, well, yeah, hopefully next week they'll do something to correct this. You know, I mean just, I don't know, unless they have to, like, maybe they'll grab the waitress from Mad Men, the last season of that, and insert her into another lesbian sex scene just to make it up.
No. And of course, oh, by the way, I say all that about the lesbian sex scene, but we know if this was on HBO and they didn't go artsy, we just saw it gratuitous, all like, I would have been all about it. Let's face it. Anyway, I have hormones. So next week's episode, I believe it's called Digestivo. So obviously after a fine Italian meal, you got to worry about digesting it. Although this episode is a little bit hard to digest, quite frankly. So I think it's just one further implication that next week should be the resolution to everything as far as this first half of the season.
Yeah, so that'll be seven down, and then we're going to have presumably six, like, Red Dragon ones to finish off the season, or even series here. So hopefully they have a nice compact story land here just to make it. I'm pretty sure it's going to be.
Oh, I feel confident about the Red Dragon stuff because it's Red Dragon. And I like the actor who they got cast as Francis Dolaride. And I probably mispronounced his name, and I don't care. I had never known how to pronounce it. Is it Dolaride? Dolaride?
It's been forever since I watched either of the movies, so I don't remember.
Well, the killer from Red Dragon. The Tooth Fairy.
The Tooth Fairy, yeah.
I think it's Richard Armitage, who people will know from like the last three Hobbit movies as like one of the main guys in there.
I haven't seen those, so I don't know if I've seen them in anything yet, but I'm sure I have.
You probably have, and I'm not going to be the one to advocate seeing those three movies, quite frankly. Anyway,
of course, there's still a chance that Hannibal get renewed and stuff, but I'm kind of having the impression that if next week's episode is like this, I'm going to kind of get to the point where I'm like, you know, starting to get a little bit less stressed out that it's getting canceled. Just be like, you know, come on, you know, seriously, guys.
I guess it's hard for me to say that because they're about to finally get to the stories that I hold so dear. You know, the really good stuff. So part of me is like the decision, while I've enjoyed the decision to kind of mix and match and use earlier ideas or later ideas earlier in the timeline, because all these ideas were from Hannibal, the third book or third movie, whatever, which I'm not that big a fan of. But I hate the idea that using the lesser ideas to inspire you derails the show before we get to the really good stuff.
Yeah.
But we'll see what happens. We'll see what happens. Anyway, I think it's time to wrap this one up. Am I correct? Yes.
Yep.
Let's start doing the wrap up. Okay. So if you enjoyed this podcast and anything else we have to say, you can find us on Facebook to join the conversation there. We're Serious Steve Jama Podcast. It's easy enough to find us there. Join the page, join the conversation. You can also find us on iTunes. Serious TV Drama, type that into the search box, you'll find us. I encourage folks to subscribe to us there. Even if you're subscribing to us through our own site, you can subscribe to us there as well. I don't care. I subscribe to both. And if you like us remotely, feel free to rate and review us. If you don't like us, why did you listen this long? I don't know. And that's really all I have to say this week. I think we did that in a timely fashion. Still have a little bit of an appetite.
Yeah, I don't know. I got nothing.
Well, no. Wait, you have nothing? That sounds delicious. Worst ending to a podcast ever.